This is CliffCentral.com.
Hello there. Welcome to Opinion Booth with myself, Sonia Booth. One in four doctors have had suicidal thoughts. One in five doctors diagnosed with or treated for depression. One in 50 doctors have attempted suicide. Now, I think what is being called, well, a call of action is for either medical personnel or the public at large to wear odd socks on June the 1st to remember those who have died, to raise awareness of mental health and to reshape health culture. My guest today is a qualified medical doctor, but more importantly, a gynae in training. Tsiamo, Dr. Nax Nakanyane.
Hey.
Welcome to the Opinion Booth.
It's a pleasure.
I must say, those stats are surprising and shocking. Is it the workload, the long hours?
You know what? I actually saw that, I think just yesterday, on my timeline on Twitter, and I retweeted it. I am not aware at all of the stats, but I know that the job is quite highly demanding. It's emotionally, physically demanding, and the one way to survive is to have a good support structure. But sometimes a lot of us don't have that. And sometimes the job itself pulls you away from your support structure, and I think that's what contributes the most to the high rate of these mental conditions amongst colleagues.
Because I mean, I saw an investigative journalism show whereby some of the doctors would be on call. One shift would be more than 24 hours. Surely that's humanly impossible.
Oh, it is humanly possible, because once you do it, you can do it. But it gets hard, and for me personally, it gets harder as you go. The first time I ever did a call that lasted beyond 24 hours, I was a student. I was in my third year in university, and it was hard. I did quite a few as I went by also. And I think by the end of my studies, I was sort of used to it. I had become accustomed to staying 24 hours up without sleep. And as an intern, I remember working with this other registrar who was just tired, and it was only midnight. And he was like, you know what, this 24-hour thing needs to end. And I remember that time, you know what, no man, we just need to be stronger. And I continued on that tone. And for the longest time, I've been able to like just carry on throughout the night for 24 hours. And sometimes it's 24 hours. Actually, most of the time, it's 24 hours and beyond. You get some of us staying in for a total of 30 hours. I have at some point started work at, I think, 6 in the morning, and went home at 5 p.m. the following day. I was still an intern, quite strong and resilient at the time. But yeah, we get used to it. But sometimes it does take a toll. And many of us wish for it to come to an end. Many other departments don't do 24-hour calls anymore because it's considered unsafe beyond certain number of hours. Anesthetists don't hardly ever do 24-hour calls, depending on where they are. And I think it's also related to the demand of a call also, because some specialists, they do their calls at home, so they don't have to be physically at work. So those ones, they'll still continue doing 24-hour calls. But the ones that are still quite resistant to this, and it's mostly due to manpower and having the numbers in to carry on the work. I think the most resistant currently would be obstetrics and gynae. And I think general surgery also, those are the ones that I think in most instances you find that a lot of us still do 24-hour calls and beyond.
Because, I mean, for the human body, and I mean mentally as well, to be expected to perform for more than 24 hours at a particular time, sleep deprivation, you become irritable. Surely the you cannot be performing at your optimum level.
No. we don't, but I survive on naps. We all do. At some point, you need to take that 30-minute nap or that 1-hour nap. Sometimes you can't afford to take it at all. That has happened a few times. But there are times where you have to, you know, just sit down, recuperate and whatever. It's you're still not at your maximal. But if you look at the stats, if you look at our government system, our, basically doctors in government, the numbers of doctors needed to treat the people in our community is a lot, lot smaller than what we have. And the thing is, it's us pushing in and putting in the work for the sake of the greater good.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because when I was researching for the show yesterday, I came upon a statistic in 2013 which stated that 25 state doctors and 92 private sector doctors per 100,000 people in South Africa. That's a recipe for disaster.
I'm actually surprised that we're still going on with these numbers. But I can assure you, some places suffer. Some people suffer a lot more than others. And that's generally because in some places you've got much bigger numbers of patients coming in compared to the doctors that need to come in. And that is the greatest difficulty that we have. And sometimes I sit and think, how long can I still push on like this? And I wonder if I'll continue until I need to or whatever. And but for some reason, there's only that energy kick comes in at some point, especially if you need to. And at times, you don't just go to sleep if you've got patients who are dying. So you sort of go through and check what's happening. And if you've got, and I know it sucks for the waiting patient, but if it's a relatively stable patient that, could probably wait a little bit, and again it really depends on what it is, then you can try and squeeze in that 30-minute nap. But if it's something that you really need to do at that time, you go and push for it. And sometimes sleep, honestly, for many of us is a dream on call. And generally I'm pretty sure a lot of doctors agree with me on this one, that some of us actually carry bad luck in terms of the number of patients that come in on your call. There's some of us who actually, even when the nurses see you coming in, they're like, oh, we're going to have a busy night.
Interesting.
Yeah. I never believed in this. As a student, and I think the beginning of my internship, I never really believed in this, because I thought, it's just superstition. Until I realized certain patterns. And it's still superstition, but you kind of get that there's certain people who get busier than others. I have a colleague who always had a certain particular complication whenever she was on call. And that's just how it is. But again, when it comes to sleep, we still perform. I can't explain it how, but we still do it. And for now, I guess we are okay. But there's doom that will come upon us at some point, I think.
Now tell me about this crazy socks for docs. Can anyone partake, or is it just for medical doctors or medical students?
I'll admit I'm not very clued up on it exactly. But I think,
but we can check online.
I think everybody is welcome to participate, because
to show support.
Yeah,
exactly.
It shows that you understand that, the things that these people are putting themselves through.
Yes.
In essence, if you're a doctor and you choose to work for government, you are sacrificing a certain part of your life.
I can imagine.
You are sacrificing a personal relationship with somebody who needs you to be there with them. You're sacrificing certain friendships. You're sacrificing your own social life. And to even decide to study and work at the same time, that's also another sacrifice in itself. But we do it because we have that want and need to do it. And I think that's what, personally, that's what drives me. And I feel most doctors who do it from purely from because from knowing that they have to or they need to, that's where their passion comes from and that's what drives them.
Because you have to be selfless. I mean, you are telling me you're a gynae in training and you're going to qualify in 2021.
2021,
that's
yes.
3 years.
Yeah, in a few months.
It's many years of studying. I mean, sure. How do you do it? I mean, it takes what? You were saying that you don't want to put a timeline to it. I mean, I've heard to specialize, it takes 12 years?
No,
this is after 12 years of studying.
No.
Primary school and high school.
Well, okay. Primary school, high school, 12 years.
Yes.
And then med school, if you go straight into med school, it's 6 years.
Yeah.
Most universities. And then you get 5.
To specialize
in some universities like University of the Free State, that's where I studied, it's 5 years. I did it longer.
So 5 years, this is just a medical degree.
That's just a medical degree.
Not a specialty.
But most universities, it's actually 6 years.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then from there on, you have 2 years of internship. I always say these are the two worst years of anybody's life who's a doctor. This is a point where most of us, I've seen it amongst my friend, I've seen it in me, and I've seen it in interns that came after me, that that's where you start questioning whether you really want to do this or not. And at the end of it, most people still want to, which is I think that's the better side of it. But this is where you actually experience most of the important disciplines in medicine. There's those that you will hate, and there's others which you will love, and there's others which are just comfortable but you still don't want to do them.
Mm-hmm.
but at the end of the 2 years, then you still have 1 year of community service where you have to work at any given government hospital, and at the end of that you are now free to do as you please.
I see.
With your degree. So you can either work as a general practitioner in private.
Yeah.
You can continue working as a medical officer. It's like a general practitioner, I mean.
Yeah.
In government hospitals or clinics. Or you can move towards your specialty. But now getting into you to specialize, you need to get into a program, right? We call it reg time or registrar time. So you become a registrar. You have to register. It has to be it's specific hospitals which are affiliated to the 8 or 9 medical schools in South Africa, and you register with those hospitals, right? And then there's certain exams that you have to write with the College of Medicine of South Africa. There's primary. Primary exams, and in some disciplines, intermediates and final exams. These are all facilitated by the College of Medicine of South Africa, where at the end of the exams, then you are a qualified specialist in whatever you're doing. But you should have also done the time, which is 4 years in most disciplines. And within those 4 years, you continue to study, improve on your skill. You are being taught. There's regular academic meetings that you attend and stuff like that, and you're still working. So you're still the tool of the hospitals. So.
Shoo. Okay. Yeah. So no wonder there's very few doctors that are graduating. Because I mean, wow. Okay. Yeah. So yeah. I can imagine the dropout rate is quite high. Like you said. Once you get what do you call it when you do your practicals,
your internship,
you reckon the dropout rate is pretty high at that point in time.
Some people, actually, a lot of people just still carry it through, and I found that a lot of us actually end up not liking it still beyond internship. But it's something that you've invested quite a lot of your time in.
And money.
Yes, exactly. So it's only a few who will decide, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore, and they find something else to do. Others find a passion in something else related to medicine, which they never knew was there until they discovered it. I have a friend who's now in research, and she's loving it, and it's medical research. But I remember she really, really did not want to continue with medicine after internship. And then, yeah, so there are those who just stick it through, and then the others who branch out and find something that they will love either within this, or some just decide, you know what, it's a qualification I have, might as well make a living out of it, and then they continue doing what they're doing.
Well, big ups to you for sticking it out. So only the Chuck Norrises of the medical fraternity will actually end up with the title doctor and moreover to even specialize. Yeah. So now, Tsiamo, that's your first name.
Yes.
Righteousness of God. That's your name.
Yes.
It is fine. That's the other meaning.
That's another.
It is okay. Yes. That's the other meaning. All things are good. That's the other meaning. Moreover, you were born on April Fool's Day. With a name like that, Tsiamo, righteousness of God, and then he's born on April Fool's Day. I think your life is full of ironies. I mean, some might call it a paradox of some sort. I mean, did you live up to your name as a kid?
No. Maybe. I don't know.
maybe I should ask your parents.
I wasn't particularly a naughty child. But I did do some naughty things. Like, you know, children will be naughty. But I wasn't a problem child, per se. I've always been a goody-goody.
You look like a goody-goody.
Thanks.
Maybe it's just the facade.
I don't know. I grew up with extremely strict parents. They were both teachers. Growing up, I grew up in a small village and everybody knew everybody. And there was, growing up, there was still primary school, middle school and high school. My mother was a principal of the middle school.
Oh dear.
And my father was a principal of the high school.
Oh dear.
And that was still back when corporal punishment was a thing.
Oh my word.
So everybody who would see us would be like, how do you guys survive your home? Because they know they've been through both of them, and they just like, you know, with such strict parents, I don't think I'd be able to do whatever. But they were strict but lenient at the same time. It's such a confusing concept. But there's certain things that they tolerated, and certain things that they didn't allow, and certain things that they allowed, right? They were strict in the sense that they needed discipline, but they did not deny us basic things to make us happy. And they're very loving parents who basically made sure that we receive that from them as parents. And yeah, I could write a book about my parents and what they do.
Well, you should. Nothing's stopping you from doing that. You should. In fact, I'm putting it out in the universe that you need to write a book. Exactly.
Okay.
So now, tell me about that moment when you decided to specialize in women's sexual and reproductive health care.
Moment.
Mm-hmm. Because I'm very curious what was going through your head.
There was never a moment. It's something I realized at some point that I actually love this. And I always find it difficult to answer this question. People often ask, why gynae?
And do your friends call you a pervert? No.
Some people have assumed that I'm perverted.
Uh-huh.
But I always say, if you're a doctor and you've been through the obstetric ward, especially labor ward, you could never label a gynecologist a pervert. If you were to see the things that they've seen, any man who has been in with his wife during labor, I mean, I once met this guy who was just like, you know what, I was there when my woman delivered, and after that he just couldn't look at her the same way for like 6 months. So it's nothing perverted.
Wow.
Yeah, it's nothing perverted. It's bloody. It's the other word, which I will not use because it's also quite straining and hard. But what actually made me love it was the whole life process of it.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing a woman coming to you first time after knowing that she's pregnant, going with her through her 9 months of her pregnancy and making sure that at the end of it, she's got a healthy, alive child. Unfortunately, there's some instances where, you know, complications happen and whatever, but I mean, that is where the passion is. That's what drives me. The want and need to see the woman happy that time when she hears her child cry the first time. New life, basically, and all of that. And I realized this as a student that, you know, I actually love this. But funny thing, when I was still in high school, I would, when people knew that, you know, I was interested in becoming a doctor, particularly in matric, some girls would ask, so when you become a doctor, what do you want to specialize in? And just for laughs, I'd be like, I want to be a gynecologist. And I only said that because they saw that or they heard that and they thought, ah, this one is perverted and blah, blah. So I only said that for the sake of laughs, right? And as a student, in the first half of my years, I saw some videos which I was not particularly fond of regarding gynae,
mm-hmm.
right? Which included a video of a pap smear and a video of a woman giving birth. That initial, that first experience, I did not enjoy. And at some point, I was just like, I do not want to do this. And then when later, when I started, when we started doing clinical rotations and I was going to now go into the obstetrics and gynae rotation, I was just like, dear Lord, help me through the next 6 weeks and I'll be happy. I just want to get through this, pass the exam and, you know. But oddly enough, even within the first week, I just fell in love with the whole thing. And it was totally different. And I don't know if it was the babies or the happy mothers or what, but yeah. That's when I actually fell in love with it. Odd enough, I failed in university. And I failed my fourth year because of obs and gynae. That's the subject I failed. But still, that did not deter me. That became the thing that I wanted. I still was like, you know, even though I failed this, this is where I'm happiest. And if there was ever doubt at the end of my studies, during internship, you remember I said this is the worst 2 years of an intern's life. It'll be the worst 2 years except for one or two rotations where you find something that you love. That's for those who will find it a department they love. And I was happiest during my 4 months in obs and gynae. That's when I was, and it was busy, it was rough, it was tough, but at the end of each day, I was the happiest in those 4 months compared to the rest of the 2 years. So that's when I was like, you know what, yeah, I'm definitely taking this route.
So I mean, when you look at the stats again, the sky-high medical negligence claims, they're forcing obstetricians out of private practice, yeah?
Yes.
So much so that the Gynecological Society has warned that there won't be any left in the private sector by 2020.
Yes.
Is that's a fact? Is that a fact?
That's what being said. I can't say if it's a fact or not, but that's where we're moving towards. I don't know if you know how much they pay for... Just for legal aid.
For medical insurance?
Yeah.
For gynaes?
Gynaes.
Something like 300,000 a month?
Oh, no, it's 100,000 a month.
100,000. Yeah, it's still a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. It's like a million in a year.
Yeah.
You could literally buy a flat within a year.
Of course.
Yeah, but that's what they expected to pay just to practice. And you can't practice without that insurance. There are ways that they're trying to make it less expensive and with certain plans and whatnot, but still, it's still quite ridiculously high, especially if you were to compare it with what other departments are paying. And it's actually a sore topic to my heart because it stems from the lawyers who come after these gynecologists, right?
Uh-huh.
And I'm not saying it's okay to be negligent. I'm not saying it's okay to not be held accountable if a woman under your care ends up with a baby with brain damage. I'm not saying that's okay, right? But none of us go to university to study so that we can harm other people. None of us decide, you know, I'm going to be an obstetrician just so that women can have babies with non-functional brains or partially functional brains. Sorry for that. But it happens. They are common complications, and they can't even be proven to be due to negligence. Sometimes you can do everything perfect and the baby comes out with cerebral palsy, and the reason being something else unrelated but can be proven. And the way the law works, it's almost like if you can't prove that you're not wrong, then you are wrong. For the medical fraternity, it's almost like you're guilty until proven otherwise. So a lot of these settlements are done outside court, obviously, because the moment the lawyers see, you know what, because of this and that, you know. And a lot of times it comes just down to how we make our notes, right? And most of us have horrible writing. I'm one of them.
most doctors
most,
do.
Yeah, most of us have really, really horrible writing.
What do you call it? Shorthand. Don't you use shorthand? No.
Well, we do for some things, but sometimes you just scribble. Sometimes I look at my notes and I'm like, what am I... You know,
you can't read your own handwriting.
Yeah, sometimes a lot of us actually find ourselves trying to read our own handwriting, and you're still trying to figure out. The only thing that actually makes you make sense of what you wrote is the context.
Uh-huh.
So you see that, okay, that word actually looks, oh, yeah, no, that's. So there's that, right? And the other key point is a lot of things that happen, we don't write, okay, I booked this patient for a Caesar at this time. Couldn't do the Caesar because of this and this and this. You know it's happening, right? But you've got 10 other patients to take care of. So you can't sit there for 10 minutes to write notes about why you can't help this particular patient. You move on to the next patient. You make notes. They're quite cryptic most of the time, right? And then there's this one patient who decides they're going to sue. And when he comes back, they go through your notes and they're like, ish, there's something missing here.
Uh-huh.
And they ask you, and you said, well, this is what happened. And you're like, yeah, well, you didn't write it. And because you didn't, you can't prove that you did say it, right?
Oh, dear.
So that's when you basically are now held liable medically. And that's where the lawyers, that's how they are actually taking it. That's how they're winning their cases. That's how they win the cases against the medical people. So when it comes to obstetrics, not obstetrics specifically, you get, and the thing is, the studies show that, you know, a lot of these babies that are born with brain dysfunction or like cerebral palsy, it is not due to problems related to labor. But because it can't be on a particular case, you can't say this one wasn't because of
lack of oxygen.
Yes, whatever. Because for that particular case, you can't prove it. And many particular cases as such, that's why they're always winning, right? And they get a lot of this money. And it is always extrapolated to a number of years and whatever. And it's millions. It's in millions. And the family gets some of it, but a lot of it the lawyers get too. And this is speculation. I'm not I hope they don't come after me and say I'm I'm accusing them of these things, but yeah, it's said that, you know, the whole road accident fund, they went at it and they've depleted the funds there, and because of that, now they found another low hanging fruit, and that's us. And for us to function, we have to protect ourselves from these lawsuits. And now in private, that's where you find that the legal aid fees are so high, and a lot of obstetricians are deciding to shut their doors and stop practicing at all, because you have to now actually push in more patients to work, and now you're gonna end up working far more than you would like to in private, and end up now risking more adverse effects, and that's when you end up now getting sued again, just because you're trying to make up money so that you cover yourself, and then you actually find yourself getting sued for things that you probably are not even responsible for.
Uh-huh. So I think essentially what you're saying is that justification of the gynae cost, because gynae's are expensive.
And the thing is, if you look back 5 years ago, I don't really know the stats, I'm just thumbsucking this, but if you look about 5, 6, 7 years ago, a gynae appointment was a lot cheaper than it is now. What it is now, it can't even be covered by medical aid alone.
1,500 for like a 15-minute consultation. It's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. And most of that really it's just so that they cover the cost. I mean, how are you going to cover 100,000 in a month? Yeah.
Okay, so now talking about medical insurance claims, I heard a story whereby a child was born holding in their hand a contraceptive coil, and the mother sued the gynae for child maintenance.
You really put me on a spot on that one. So, contraceptions. Okay, that's actually one of the really highly active contraceptions. I do not know the merits of that case. I do not know what he had done before and whatnot. But none of the contraceptions that we have are 100% sure proof.
True.
Right? There's always that 0.000 something, right? And it'll happen. With 7 billion people in the world, it will happen, right? But I think it might just be that he didn't inform her. I'm assuming. Or he might have not done something that he should have done, like get a pregnancy test before he puts in the... Because she might have already been pregnant.
Okay, I see.
So there's that. So I can't really comment on that. I would need to, you know, find out his story.
I just made that up, by the way.
Well, I'm glad I was able I'm glad I was able to come up with some sense.
I mean,
to it.
The lawsuit part was made up, but you've known.
I've never seen it.
Yeah, I grew up hearing of stories whereby the child comes out, you know, crying, and they're holding this loop, as they call it.
Yeah,
we grew up. Yeah,
I've heard of those stories, but it's always amazing when I tell a woman, you know, let's try this contraception. They're like, yeah, no. I heard they don't work, and honestly, loops are one of the best working the best contraceptions that we have. That and the Implanon, those are the best ones we have. And everything else, there's always the user factor and everything like that. But the intrauterine device and the Implanon are the best ones we have. And they have got like really, 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 really low failure rates. So, but again, I'm saying really, 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 really low. I'm not saying no failure rate. So that's why there can be some form of explanation.
Mm-hmm. What they call an oops.
Yeah, yes.
Oops, I fell pregnant.
Yeah. I always say nothing is absolute in health.
True.
In medicine, yeah. Nothing is absolute. No.
So you ran a poll the other day where you asked women what they would opt for if given a choice between a vaginal delivery and C-section. 74% voted for vaginal and 26% for C-section.
Yes.
I've heard horror stories surrounding natural birth. I mean, labor pains lasting more than 24 hours, to women climbing walls at the hospital as if there was Spider-Man. Talking about Spider-Man, your scrubs have an image of Superman.
Superman, yes.
Superman logo across the chest. Yes. That's cute. What brought that on?
I've I actually grew up being a Superman fan. Just from the young age when I was still in preschool, I loved Superman. Part of the reason was because my father actually draws sometimes when he feels like it.
Uh-huh.
He grew up reading comics, so he liked also just drawing. And he does this wonderful, in about 30 minutes, he'll take a pen, not even a pencil, and make a sketch of Superman. It's absolutely beautiful.
That's where your obsession comes from.
I think so.
So it's also a conversation starter. I mean, I like that. You are with a patient, and then they're looking across your chest, and they're just seeing this Superman logo.
It has a story. But apart from that, I grew up loving Superman, sure. But somebody... once associated me to Superman because he was like, you know, the thing that you guys do as a doctor,
as a doctor.
As a doctor, and she was like, you know, you are literally Superman to these mothers, and
but you are,
and I was just like, nah, man, I'm just doing what I have to do. And she was like, no, you are Superman. And it became something that actually pushed me. But the scrubs themselves, I was looking at some of the, I've got a Black Panther scrub also. I'm that kind of a fan.
Okay. Yeah.
So I was just looking
at
them.
Cool doctor.
And I looked at it and I thought, maybe I should have scrubs made this way. And I was just thinking out loud. And I said this to my girlfriend. And she's like, oh, yes, we should make you. And I'm like, oh, okay. I thought she was joking. Next thing, she's telling me about this lady who does scrubs and whatever. And then next thing, yeah, I've got the Superman scrubs. And yeah.
That is super cool. I like that. So now you had two thumbs up when I was talking about the stats that came about your poll. Why is that? You seem to be for vaginal delivery?
I am absolutely for vaginal delivery.
Even with the risks of vaginal tearing.
I was reading a lot of women actually commented. I needed them to comment, but I didn't respond to many of the. I hardly responded to any of them. This poll came up because I was actually doing I was preparing a presentation which I did this morning about giving women the option to choose a C-section. As a mode of delivery versus going for normal vaginal delivery. And I just wanted to know what the rest of the people, what people actually feel. And as much as there are horror stories related to normal vaginal delivery, there's also equally same horror stories related to C-sections. What people don't realize is although the woman is not screaming and crying and trying to push the baby out, we are during the Caesar. It might not be the first one. The first one is quite easy. The anatomy is nice, and you know, you just do a Caesar, baby out, and it's cool, right? If it's uncomplicated. But at times, with subsequent Caesars, right, you run the risk of conditions which end up either bleeding the woman to death, if you can't actually stop the bleeding, or she loses her womb, which becomes another factor in itself. So you've got conditions like placenta previa and accreta, which could lead to the woman bleeding profusely during a Caesar. And should that happen, she might end up with you taking the womb out. And maybe this is a woman who, although her second Caesar, it is probably her only first child. Or the baby has even died, but you need to do this procedure because there's no other way of delivering the baby. Or she wants five children and all of that. And apart from that, there's also like... surgery-related complications where you've got like adhesions and you have to like now work through those adhesions to get to the womb and all of that. So it can become a nightmare for us doing the operation. She doesn't notice it. She's just there. Most times they are awake, right? When she is bleeding out and the anesthetist is also, Akila should be, the anesthetist is also doing her best to, you know, to maintain the patient and whatever. At some point, put them to sleep and you have to do the rest of the, or what you need to do. The thing is, it always comes down to risk versus benefit, right? So the overall risks related to just doing seizures, they're higher compared to normal vaginal deliveries. Yes, somebody said you get a you get tears sometimes, right? Sometimes you have to actually cut the vagina so to allow the baby to come out. An episiotomy.
Wow.
That's called an episiotomy. It's what we do, but it's not that bad compared to what you get with a Caesar. It's actually not that bad at all. However, Caesars have their benefits, right? You have a more controlled delivery. You sort of are more in control as the doctor.
You can pick a date.
Yes,
I did.
You can pick a date and stuff like
that. Well, for the second child. The first one, I didn't have a choice. It was an emergency C-section.
Yes, you see. So, but it can, a lot of times it doesn't, but it can go south quite badly. And a lot of times normal vaginal deliveries actually go quite well and you don't get those tests that people speak about and whatnot. And the woman walks out of the hospital within 6 hours.
Jeez.
With a Caesar, you stay there for like 2 days, 3 days,
and
4 days.
And the pain, my word.
Sometimes a week. And some patients come back 2 weeks later with wound sepsis.
Yeah.
And then they stay again in hospital. And those are things that I personally don't like seeing. Sometimes you take the patient back into theater to now remove the wound because there's been sepsis, affected the wound.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's a lot of this as much
pros
as,
and cons, yes.
And women, most women just know the horror of labor itself. But they, a lot of don't understand the horrors related to Caesars themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. So generally it's, I'm an advocate for normal vaginal deliveries. But yeah, bring another gynecologist here and they might say something else.
So you're a male gynae, that we know. Would you consider a female urologist?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. No qualms about it.
No.
Not shy. No. As a black man?
No, not at all.
Having another woman examining you? No?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now, on Sunday, you tweeted, disclaimer, I am straight and in a relationship, highly actively so. Enlighten me. What led to that tweet?
Oh,
too many DMs? Too many proposals?
Actually, I don't have as many DMs as people assume. I do get DMs, which some are quite suggestive. They're both from females and males, and most of the time I just look at the high and I'm like, okay, cool, I move on. I don't even respond. Sometimes I feel maybe I'm being a bit too rude, so I respond, and then at some point I have to say, you know what, I'm straight, or I've got a girlfriend, and then it stops most times. And then there's those who'll be like, oh, can we be friends? And I'm like, okay. I never know. I never understand the whole can we be friends, because you don't generally ask a person to become a friend. You just become friends. So I try not to be rude. So I just say yes. And then I'll respond to messages until they tire from responding. And yeah. But my DMs are not as active as people think they are. And I'm fine with them the way they are.
And then there's also another girl who puts your picture on her WhatsApp profile picture. You've got some weird followers. I mean, I'd be worried. I'd hire bodyguards if I were. You've got stalkers and psychos. No,
apparently, this is in another country. But somebody tells me that her friend puts my picture, which is on Twitter, as a WhatsApp picture, as every time she fights with a boyfriend, and that usually is apparently it works as an emotional blackmail to the guy. And I'm like, but how does it work? How does this guy just fall for this? Why does it become a thing? Because I mean, I don't think I'd take it the same way. It definitely wouldn't make me run back to a woman if she was to put a picture of another guy as a DP. But yeah, I just found it weird, and I was like, oh, okay, cool.
Okay, wow, you've got a very interesting life. Now tell me, You spoke about the challenges and difficulties, I mean, those particular 2 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
What gives you motivation to continue? What gives you reason to wake up the following morning? Because you've already described how difficult it is to end up with the title doctor.
Can I tell you, most times, just a simple thank you from a patient.
I like that.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Most times, that have been the most fulfilling things I've had, where I help a patient and they just say, you know what, thank you for being the person you are. Thank you for being so kind and all of that. And was like, you know, this is why I do this. And yeah.
Simple as that.
When it comes to me, I don't know about other people, but honestly, just that thank you just means the world to me. We don't get a lot of them, by the way. Some patients we actually do fight with, and sometimes things don't go as well between you and the patient, but you know, you're forced to become the bigger man in that. And I always try conflict between me and my patients. If I see a patient and she's not happy with something that I did, I ask, why did I not do right? How would you like me to improve this and whatnot? And I do my best to be the best to my patients. But it sometimes becomes a little bit emotionally draining. But a lot of patients actually are appreciative. They see you the morning you walk in. They see you at 10 p.m. and they see you still in the same clothes that you are in the following morning. And they're like, didn't you go home to sleep? And
you're like, you didn't wash.
I'm like, I've been here. Don't worry, I'll go home soon. And you're like, yeah, you better be safe and go home. And like, yeah. And you, funny thing is, you actually get this more from the grannies who will be like, you know what? Thank you for being who you are. Thank you for doing what you're doing. And I'm not saying that the younger people do not are not thankful.
They probably have a sense of entitlement,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. But many do thank us. But you get it more from the senior people.
Shame on those patients. But, I mean, a thank you doesn't cost much, does it?
It doesn't.
It also, it motivates you, as you've stated.
It really does motivate me.
Because you know you appreciate it.
Yes. It's just the opposite that becomes. Like the lawsuits that we were talking about, you will be, you know, you'll think you've done something great. And some of the, I don't want to get into this, but some of the lawsuits, right, you find that this patient left your offices. These are things that I've been told, obviously, by my seniors and people who are in private, that, you know, a person leaves your office and with a smile on their face and they're happy and whatever. Next thing, you called by a lawyer and they're asking about a particular case, and you get surprised that this patient wants to sue because they felt they were not treated well in a certain way, or they were not shown this or whatever. So you wonder, like, you know, do you really want to help people who are not even appreciative, even if there wasn't an adverse outcome? And yeah, you get some of those people who somehow feel, I don't know if it's a matter of they feel, you know what, this person was too expensive, I want my money back, or what, I don't know, I really don't
you
understand.
You think they would sue just to get the money back?
I think that it's something like that, honestly, but yeah, I'm not particularly fond of such people, but yeah.
Aha, okay. Dr. Max, thank you so much for your time.
Is it time already?
I know.
Oh wow!
I know. Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah,
I'm glad you asked that question, because then I'm glad, because it obviously means that you enjoyed your time
in
the opinion booth.
Yeah, thank you.
And all the best for the next 3 years. Wow, you're gonna get on the graduation podium, right, in 2021.
Yes.
Don't forget to share pictures.
I will.
Send an email to say, by the way, I'm graduating tomorrow, just so that we can post, so that we show appreciation and that we show that we are proud of you and your achievements, because you're in the lendlela. Wow. Yeah. All the best to you.
Thank you.
Wow. Okay. And these are your beautiful words, by the way. I stole these from your blog. You will remember these beautiful words. And that is how I'm going to conclude my show. I don't have a humble opinion today, but I thought Dr. Knox's words are very encouraging and very motivating. Mothers are the backbone of our society, the motivation in many of us who go out and change the world. with each and every one of us in everything we do individually to make the world a better place. We must consider ourselves as gifts from our mothers to the world, because we are who we are because of who they have been through their lives, through our lives. Let's appreciate the wonder that is a woman, the woman who became a mother and excelled in it. Let's continue to love and show appreciation for who they are to us and to the world. To all the mothers out there, we thank you. Those are beautiful words. Now I understand why you studied training towards becoming a gynecologist. Yeah. It makes sense. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for being.
Thank you for having me. And yeah. Thank my mother and my father for me.
you obviously have incredible parents. I don't need to conclusion.
They are absolutely incredible.
Wow.
We'll have another show and I'll just speak about them.
Oh wow. Yeah. Okay. So I think that was a dedication to your mom and dad.
Yes.
Dr. Knox, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Aspire to inspire before you expire.
This is CliffCentral.com.